Tonight on the Daily Debrief, prosecutors say a family of four was murdered in their home. The defense asks, why no blood at the scene? Also, jury selection in the case of a Georgia woman accused of starving a relative to death. She could face the death penalty herself, and she's representing herself. Plus, law and politics cross yet again in the wake of the Mueller report. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Monday, April 22nd.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Imran Ansari and Michael Bryant along with me tonight. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you.
All right, let's get straight to it here. First tonight, the McStay family murders in California. Defendant Charles Merritt, he goes by Chase, is accused of killing his business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family. The family disappeared in 2010, and authorities stopped looking for clues after they presumed the family had vanished into Mexico. Years later, the graves of all four of the McStays turned up in the Mojave Desert. Defense tests on two items found buried with the McStay family in shallow graves revealed the DNA of the DNA profiles of three unknown people. The unknown profiles came from a rope tied around Joseph McStay's neck and from Summer McStay's bra, which was cut, presumably by her attacker or her attackers. The unknown profiles are from none of the McStays and are not from defendant Chase Merritt. Who are they from? And are they from the real killers? Also, why did the defense have to perform their own tests on these items after tests by state authorities failed to yield these clues? The defense is naming another man as the person responsible for the killings. Dan Kavanaugh is that individual, and he claimed to have been in Hawaii when the McStays disappeared. But defense forensics experts say that might not be true. Someone accessed Kavanaugh's PayPal account from a Hawaii IP address on January 14th. The account, however, was accessed from Southern California January 26th through February 14th. The family disappeared February 4th in the middle of that period. The account was not accessed from outside Southern California until April 17th, when it was accessed in Washington State. Today in court, a defense expert pushed back at police claims that they might have seen blood on a table at the McStay home, but never collected it. And the defense counteracted the prosecutor's theory that the McStays were even killed in their own home.
Did you notice that some of the things you were not seeing in these photographs?
Yes.
And please describe for the jury some of the things that you're not seeing that you would look for.
Blood evidence. And specific to really any kind of blood pattern, white stains, swipe stains, impact patterns, which we'll talk more later about, I believe, along with drip stains and a drip trail to indicate that either someone was bleeding at a scene or someone was had suffered a blunt force trauma within the house somewhere. I did not observe any of that type of blood.
Did you see any damage to any of the walls?
No.
To the doors?
No.
To the windows?
No.
Flooring?
No.
Anything in the surfaces that were consistent in your experience of major blunt force trauma?
No.
Anything in that house stand out as a clear indication of extensive violence occurring in that home?
No.
Further, but the prosecutor convinced the judge to shut down the line of questioning.
If an individual is struck in the head six times, their skull is destroyed, is broken down into little small pieces, and their blood pooling would be extensive. After suffering such injury, would you expect that blood pooling to be left at the scene if the body was removed?
Same objection, lacks foundation, would be hypothetical.
That's the exact testimony.
And assumes facts not enough.
The objection sustained. I think all of these issues were addressed by the pathologist.
Right, but this information is necessary for his further conclusions of what he sees from that blood evidence. This is all foundational for where he will testify later.
The objection still sustained.
The defense put the witness back on track by asking him to explain blood spatter stains and stains left when blood is cast off of an attack weapon. Of course, we don't have those at the scene, but the witness still talked about them in the negative. Imran Ansari and Michael Bryant here tonight. So let's jump into this. What's up with this objection, Imran? The prosecution does not want the jury to hear it out of the defense that this stuff isn't there. So objection, speculation, assumes facts not in evidence, and the defense is like, wait a minute, that's the exact testimony.
Right. You know, the objection was sustained, but I really think that the defense still gets what they want out there through this expert. The lack of blood splatter at the scene. The prosecution has married themselves to this crime happening at the house. And I'm sorry, but the forensic evidence is just not there.
Okay, so was it a good objection? Do you agree with the judge's ruling, Michael?
Well, I don't know that it mattered to parrot what Dameron is saying here, because the message was very clear, and I don't know how much you have to, pardon the phrase, beat the jury over the head with some of this information for them to understand it. Where is the blood? Nobody's answered that question yet from the prosecution.
Okay, and I keep going back to the DNA. What's going on with the three unknown DNA profiles? I mean, seriously, like I'm running out of moments to have my jaw on the desk here and have somebody lift it back up. Like, what is going on with the state's case here?
Right, so DNA evidence, juries want to hear that. You know, it's a big part of cases, criminal cases these days. The fact that there's no definitive DNA evidence really hurts the prosecution case. Now the mystery unknown, the fact that this DNA does not go back to merit, it's not good for the prosecution.
Exactly. They have the burden. We're going to keep on top of this case. Jury selection also slowly progressing in the trial of a Georgia woman accused of starving her stepdaughter to death. Tiffany Moss is charged in connection with the death of her 10-year-old stepdaughter, Imani Moss, and for burning the girl's dead body to try and hide the evidence. Prosecutors say she took care of her own children but neglected Imani. Moss is taking her life in her own hands by representing herself in her own death penalty case. She has had one small victory so far, keeping a woman in the jury pool who said in court she is not in favor of the death penalty. Law and Crime's Vincent Hill is in the courtroom for jury selection and discussed the case earlier today on the network.
What's very interesting is they're bringing each potential juror in one by one and then asking those questions. Typically, we see at least the entire seat of 12 people seated, and then they are asked those questions. But the judge in this case is bringing them in one by one. And most of the people here, Bob, surprisingly say they are not in support of the death penalty. And that's one reason this jury selection has been going on for as long as it has. One lady earlier today, I believe juror number 92, stated, hey, I'm an ordained minister. I believe in redemption, not death penalty. Who are we to say someone needs to be put to death? But this is a very interesting case as well, because a lot of the people, at least this morning when I was inside the courtroom, were saying, hey, I can't understand why she's representing herself. They understand that's her right. But they said if it was them facing a murder charge, a death penalty case, there's no way they would be representing themselves. So jury selection is a very slow process because of those two issues. One thing that's interesting about Tiffany Moss, I sat behind her this past Friday when I was in the courtroom. Of course, I sat within feet of her this morning. You know, she's walking in the courtroom very confident, you know, and she's telling the judge, no questions for this juror, no questions for that juror. So she seems like she understands, but the talk here in Atlanta is, there has to be something wrong with you mentally, not only to burn your child, starve your child, your stepchild, but then to say, oh, I want to represent myself. So she may come back later and say, well, there were signs, you know, I was reported. Nobody did anything about it. So how are you going to hold me liable?
Speaking with my co-host, Bob Bianchi, earlier today, let's bring Imran Ansari and Michael Bryant in to discuss this case. So the defendant representing herself, Michael, people keep saying, is this grounds for appeal? I think it's really tough because the judge surely, if the judge is doing his or her job, is asking all the questions necessary to make it really clear to this defendant, hey, look, you have much better choices here.
I mean, there's certainly going to be an issue, an appellate issue. We know that. Whether it wins the day or not, it's another story. If the judge has done his job and has asked the right questions and got on the record the right answers, that she is making this knowingly and intelligently, and by the way, there's also counsel helping her if she needs help, then the judge is going to be covered. It'll be on appeal, though.
Okay, it'll be on appeal, but Imran, do you agree that bottom line is that it might not be a winning issue for this defendant if it gets that far?
Yeah, so the judge, as Michael was saying, has really crossed his T's, dotted his I's, made sure that it's a knowing, voluntary decision by the defendant. And listen, in Georgia, it's not the first time that a defendant has gone pro se in a capital case. In 2015, Jamie Hood did that, and he was ultimately found guilty, but with a life sentence and not the death penalty.
Okay, so it might become an issue, but we don't know what the verdict's going to be yet, so we might be putting the cart before the horse. Michael, many jurors have issues with the death penalty in this case. That's a theme that's coming up, so it's getting a little bit difficult to try to seat a jury. And they've got the issue of this defendant serving as her own counsel, basically questioning the jurors, do you really want to put me to death?
Do you want to kill me? Yes. That is a bizarre scenario. And it's tough enough to get a death-qualified jury anywhere, even in Florida, where it happens every day almost. So here, the question is really, are they going to get people that are truly, honestly impartial and can impose the death penalty?
Imran Ansari as well.
Right. Listen, asking a jury to impose the death penalty is a big ask. It's going to be, jury selection is going to have to be thorough and to the point to get that jury who's fair and impartial.
And talk about a situation where the defendant basically gets to say a lot more than she would if she were just even taking the stand.
Exactly.
A curious case. We'll follow that one as it progresses towards opening statements. More people are piling onto a lawsuit tonight filed by a so-called John Doe against the Florida authorities who accused New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft of soliciting a prostitute. The spa where Kraft allegedly paid for a sexual massage became the subject of intense interest after authorities charged Kraft. Now, close to three dozen men and women have joined a lawsuit which accuses the authorities who handled the case of unlawfully recording them as they received legal massages which did not involve any sexual touching. These plaintiffs claim the sneak and peek warrant the authorities used to record what was happening at the spa was flat out unconstitutional. Also in Florida, a man accused of impersonating a police officer picked the wrong person to pull over. The Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office says Matthew Joseph Aris turned on his red and blue lights and tried to pull over a real detective. The detective did not pull over, so Aris eventually passed him, only to be pulled over by a real officer a short while later. Authorities say Aris had a realistic-looking pistol and police lights installed on his vehicle. Aris said he put the lights on his SUV so he could get through heavy traffic. And still ahead tonight, here on the Daily Debrief, attorney Michael Avenatti now being accused of taking millions from a client. Plus, more fallout from the Mueller report. Is there enough on the record for Congress to try the president? Law and politics collide yet again after the break. Welcome back to The Debrief. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's long-awaited report left open the question of whether President Donald Trump obstructed justice. Now, Democrats in Congress are deciding whether or not to open impeachment proceedings. Rachel Stockman reports.
The question of obstruction has been answered many ways by many people in the wake of Mueller's report. Attorney General William Barr gave his reasoning.
The Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense.
But Mueller's report outlined 10 examples of potential obstruction by the president, including firing former FBI Director James Comey and instructing former White House counsel Don McGahn to have Mueller removed. Longtime legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Gene Rossi says he would have filed charges.
I charged many cases with much less conduct.
If the president's name were Donald Smith and not Donald Trump, he would have been charged with obstruction.
Department of Justice guidelines state that a sitting president cannot be indicted, leaving the next step in the process up to Congress.
If you read the language of the report, he's saying, Congress, the ball is now in your court, not Barr's court.
Democratic Senator and presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren called for impeachment the day after the report was released.
The report is absolutely clear that a foreign government attacked our electoral system to help Donald Trump. He welcomed that help. And then when it was investigated by our own federal authorities, Donald Trump took multiple steps to try to obstruct justice.
The decision will likely be up to the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who so far has downplayed calls for impeachment. Even if the Democratic House did impeach the president, the Republican Senate would almost certainly prevent President Trump from being removed from office. I'm Rachel Stockman for the Law and Crime Network.
President Trump is meanwhile fighting off requests to see his tax returns, and he's now threatening legal action against the latest group to demand to see information about his finances. Lawyers for Trump and the Trump Organization are suing House Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings in order to block a subpoena for years of the president's financial records. The subpoena was sent to Mazars USA, an accounting firm Trump used to write up several years of his financial history. The House committee is seeking records related to the president, his trust, the Trump Organization, the Trump Corporation, and others. An appeals court has rejected Chelsea Manning's attempt to get out of jail early. Manning was arrested last month for refusing to testify before a grand jury investigating WikiLeaks. This all happened as the Justice Department announced charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Manning's legal team says her testimony is now unnecessary because Assange has been charged. Manning is a former U.S. Army intelligence analyst who was convicted of violating the Espionage Act by disclosing thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. Attorney Michael Avenatti, meanwhile, is now being accused of embezzling $3 million from the ex-girlfriend of an NBA player. That's according to interviews quoted in the Los Angeles Times. Miami Heat center Hassan Whiteside settled with his ex for $3 million, but Avenatti only apparently delivered $194,000 to that ex. Avenatti said he turned over far more than the $194,000 in dispute, and said that he looks forward to all of the facts coming out at trial. Sentencing last week for two parents who admitted torturing most of their 13 children and holding them captive inside a so-called California House of Horrors. Defendant David Turpin told the judge all of the abuse which he admitted to committing started with the best of intentions.
Your Honor, I thank God for all of my children. Each one of them is a blessing from God. My homeschooling and discipline had good intentions. I never intended for any harm to come to my children. I'm sorry if I've done anything to cause them harm. I'm glad we were able to resolve this case without my children being forced to testify. I love my children, and I believe my children love me. I hope and pray that my children can stay close to each other and look out for each other, since their mother and father cannot be there for them and with them. I hope the very best for my children in their future. I hope my oldest son successfully completes the two college degrees he's been working on.
I'm sorry, I needed to modify that part of the statement. I hope my oldest son and four daughters currently in college successfully complete the degrees they are working on. And I hope they are successful in their chosen professions. I'll try to continue. I wish my second son success in finalizing his career plan and completing whatever additional education may be required. I wish happiness and success for my other children as they complete their lower level education and make productive plans for their future. I am so proud of each and every one of my children. I miss all of my children, and I will be praying for them. I long for the opportunity to have contact with them again. Thank you.
Those are the words of a man who admitted to torture, dependent abuse, adult abuse, false imprisonment, and child endangerment. Here is how his wife addressed the court.
I'm sorry for everything I've done to hurt my children. I love my children so much. I'm blessed to be the mother of each one of them. I only want the best for them. Their happiness is very important to me. They are very smart, amazing individuals. I hope they get all the education they need to make their dreams come true. They deserve only the best in life. I don't want any them to be sad or depressed because of all of this. I want them to know that Mom and Dad are going to be okay. I also want them to know I believe God has a special plan for each of them. I really look forward to the day I can see them, hug them, and tell them I'm sorry. I want them to know how special they are and how very proud I am of them. I pray for my children every day. I want to say again how truly sorry I am for everything I've done to hurt them. I love them more than they could ever imagine. Thank you, Your Honor.
The judge sentenced each of these parents to 25 years to life in prison. Attorneys Imran Ansari, Michael Bryant, back with me now. So, Imran, here's what surprises me. The kids asked the court to basically lift restrictions on their ability to go back and see their parents, their own abusers. Does that surprise you at all?
Well, you got to think about the mental state of these children who are now, you know, some of them are adults. I would imagine they're fractured emotionally, psychologically. The parents were really the only people they knew. They were so compartmentalized and sheltered that you don't know what's going through these children's minds. I think there's a break between the children. Some want the restraining order, some don't. So, you know, they have a tough life ahead.
Michael Bryant, your thoughts on that as well.
Well, you know, the kids in some of these statements said, hey, go easy on them. You know, I think 25 years is too much for my mom and dad. They didn't know anything better. They didn't know what a normal childhood was like. They thought their parents were doing what they should do. And they gave them credit for the faith that they had instilled in the kids. And if you think about it, it's that faith that seems to have gotten them through the process and maybe helped them get better.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that angle as well. But, you know, you got some of these kids saying that they basically had, what, first, second grade educations and they were late teens because the parents were saying we're educating the kids at home, but they weren't doing that. They were chaining them to beds.
Right. The good news for these children is that we hear some of them aren't in college now. Mm-hmm. They're trying to pick up their life. They're trying to move on. Some are getting their master's. I believe one has a master's on their mind. So, you know, they're trying to pick up their life, move on, and live a healthy life. But I think it's going to be hard given what they've been through.
Of course. And that's good to see. Michael, fair sentence or not?
Yeah, no, I think it had to be that way. No matter how they reacted in the sentencing, the judge had to give them what he did.
Life. Tough sentence, 25 to life. Thanks a lot, guys, for coming on The Debrief tonight. And thanks to those of you who are watching along at home. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for this recap of moments and cases nationwide. We're live from 5 to 5:30 Eastern, but our live trial coverage begins tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern. Have a good night, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.